please take a few moments to review those?
Move to approve the minutes for October and September 2017.
I second that.
Who second that?
Joan.
Joan, thank you.
Vocal cords. I'm going
to take. I'm so sorry. Thank you for all the coaching. It really doesn't stick in each month. I'm sorry. I'm doing great. I don't think I'm very good. All right. Did everyone approve them?
All in favor.
All in favor. Yeah. Okay. Anyone opposed? Okay, great. So welcome.
Perfect.
Yay. Do we want to do a round of introductions? Or, yeah? Okay. So, we'll just go around and again introduce ourselves and the role that we are. So I'm Stephanie. I am a nurse practicing in Clark County.
I'm Adrienne Fairbanks. I am a doctor of veterinary medicine practicing in Clark County.
Janice Hodge, I'm with Public Health.
Marla Sanger, and I know I said last time I was leaving as a peace helper, but I returned as the consumer of public health services.
And I'm Roxanne from the Clark County Public Health. And we will have an update for the new members here on the agenda as well after the presentations.
I'm Arun Murthy. I represent medical doctors in Clark County.
Alan Melnick. I'm with Clark County Public Health.
Travis Dutton, also with Clark County Public Health.
Lydia Gurman with Clark County Public Health.
Hi, I'm Sandy Mathewson. I'm the Director of Social Emotional Learning for the Battleground School District.
I'm Steve Becker, and I am a consumer of public health services.
I'm Bob Richardson. I'm the police chief of Battleground, and I represent the law enforcement council, which is all the police chiefs and the sheriff of Clark County.
I'm Dave Fuller. I'm the director of Clark Regional Emergency Services Agency.
Remy Houston, children's dentist here in Clark County, representing the Dental Association.
Hi, John Roth. Work for Clark Public Utilities, representing public water systems in Clark County.
Mark Collier, representing Subject Designer.
Oh, I'm sorry. Specialist.
David Scott, administrator of the City of Washougal, and I represent non-elected. I'm a non-elected representative of Clark from the cities and towns. And I'm not going to say everyone except for Vancouver, and now I just
and I'm Joan
Keeley,
and I'm a community health nurse, but I sit on the council as the non-elected representative for the City of Vancouver.
I'm Sandy Brown, and I'm representing Consumer for Public Health.
Paul Childers, I represent the restaurants in Clark County.
Amy Bishop Smith, representing Clark County Youth.
Jeff Harbison, Public Health.
Heather Hunt, Public Health.
Welcome. We have a forum.
Yay!
Yay! So thank you all for coming. We are going to get some public comments. So we are shy of any public guests, so we are going to just move right past that, and we're going to move on to department updates. So Travis, do you want to go first?
Yeah. Yes, I can do that. All right, so I'm going to tell you a couple of stories tonight. I am with the Solid Waste Program, so I'm the Solid Waste Program Manager, newly implanted here about 3 months ago. So I'm going to tell you a couple of, I'm going to give you a couple of updates, and I'm going to try to be respectful of time and then also not get too excited about what I'm telling you and get down into the details because this stuff is a lot of fun. But kind of give you two updates, one on a situation or a scenario that's playing out right now globally, which is referred to as the National Sword. And then I'm going to also paint a little bit of a picture on what our inclement weather policy looks like as far as solid waste goes. So I'm going to kind of provide overviews and then leave for questions and answers. Does that sound about correct? Perfect. All right, so the first thing I am going to talk about is China's national sword. So in your packet, I did provide kind of a detailed overview that's a much bigger picture than what I'm going to talk about now. But in order to kind of paint a picture of what China's national sword is and why it matters to us, I wanted to paint a little bit of a picture as to what we do with our recyclable materials here in Clark County. So just really quick, in case anybody has done this, has anybody ever been to any of the transfer stations in Clark County?
Oh, thank you.
All right. Has anybody ever seen inside of what we call a material recovery facility? It's like a giant game of mousetrap and machines and people that are sorting out all of our recyclables. Have you guys ever been inside of one of those before? Okay. So I'm going to paint a picture for those of you who have not, but if you are a resident of Clark County and you put your mixed recyclables in your container, your papers, your plastics, you put your glass in the container next to it, all of that goes into your curbside container and gets picked up by a truck. That truck takes it to West Van Material Recovery Facility. It is all dumped onto a floor. These pictures aren't as big as I pictured them in my head, but down here you can kind of see a first image, the trucks back up and literally dump all of your mixed recyclable material down onto the floor. This tractor pushes it around inside of this facility, loads it onto a series of conveyor belts. These conveyor belts are what we call, this whole system up here, it's just a snapshot of it, but this is a MRF, or a material recovery facility. So all of your recyclable materials are mixed together, shoved onto one of these conveyor belts, and it goes through a series of human beings sorting out materials by hand, looking for things that they can grab. I wish I could show you a video. I've tried it. It goes very, very quickly. The materials are moving by them very quickly. You get motion sick if you, first couple times you try it, stuff's going by so quickly. So anyways, they're sorting out by hand. There's also optical sorters. There are magnets. There is a whole series of things. So you put in mixed materials at the very beginning. And the idea is that at the end of the line, you have different piles of materials. So you have a pile of newspaper, you have a pile of cardboard, you have a pile of aluminum cans, and it's ideally it should be all perfect.
So we put out bins with cans, and then there's the other bin. Those aren't mixed together there, are they?
The other bin. Tell me, what do you mean
bin? The green, brown, and
so the materials that you put in your bin, so you probably have the garbage, you may have a glass, you may have yard waste, and then you also have recyclables. None of those, once you have separated them, then they never get mixed again. Yeah. So when I say mixed recyclables, it's all the stuff you've mixed together in that one recycling container. So the idea is that when we are all done with that sorting process, they should look like this. So you can kind of see on the left, there is a bale of cardboard, and that gets shipped off to someplace domestically. Then you can see other bales of plastic, bales of paper, bales of other types of material, aluminum, they get shipped all over the world. So that's a very rough picture of what happens to our recyclable material. And as you can imagine, the system is not perfect. Plastic gets sorted into paper, plastic gets sorted into aluminum gets sorted into paper, things get kind of messy sometimes. Which brings me back originally to this idea of national sword. China is the purchaser of most of the domestic material that we produce and ship overseas for the intent of recycling. Most of our mixed paper ends up over in China. Most of our plastics end up over in China. Things like aluminum, cardboard, much easier to recycle domestically. Those stay over here. But for largely the West Coast, China is the largest purchaser of our recyclable materials. So now you have that whole scenario. China, in March of this year, laid out what they are calling the national sword. It's basically a national campaign to clean up their recyclers, all of the people that are purchasing things, all of the people that are purchasing, sorting, and recycling materials, and then sending them back over to us. What it does is it says that the material that has been coming over from the United States and from Europe has been too messy. So bales of paper or bales of plastic are coming over and have too much what we call contamination, which is liquid or food or plastic. Anything that's not paper is considered contamination in a bale of paper. Anything that's not plastic is considered contamination in plastic. Some places in the United States, those bales go over to China with as much as 20% contamination. On the West Coast, especially in the Pacific Northwest, cities like ours, our county, Portland, Seattle, King County, San Francisco, have a much better system, largely because their residents participate. Their residents participate, I wouldn't say better, but they're more informed on what does go inside a recycling bill. So our contaminations are traditionally, we can get them around 3 to 5% here. So we have pretty good. But what China set was what most of us would consider very strict regulations and are setting 1.5% contamination rates. In November 1st of this year, they said 1.5 contamination. And that they're saying in March of next year, 0.5% contamination, otherwise they will reject it. And essentially that would mean that no bales of recyclable materials sorted in the United States could be purchased by China. They would basically turn them back, any boat that showed up. The picture on the right, I don't know where this is. I was just looking for a picture of people sorting bales, so I'm not going to make any claim, but these are the people that are sorting ours. But you can see on any boat that shows up with a certain number of trailers, they open up a certain number, they sample them, they look for contamination. If it's acceptable, they accept the whole boat. If it's not acceptable, they turn the boat away, and it becomes the problem of the broker, the person who purchased the material from, in our case, Waste Connections. So while they've set this very strict standard, to kind of talk about how it's impacted us here, and then I want to talk a little bit about what we're doing to prepare for this. So China has set these standards. At this point, what is happening is that the MRF Waste Connections has slowed their line down. So think about it, if you compared a MRF to I-5, it would be sort of similar to closing down two lanes of I-5 during a commute. So think about, we've got slowed it down so not as much material can go into the door. But they are able to spend more time sorting the material that does go through so that they can clean that up. They've also, our facility here processes mostly material from Clark County. In order to keep it operating 24 hours a day or for two shifts a day, they are actually bringing some material up from Eugene to supplement the material that was coming from Clark County so that they could fiscally operate it and have it make sense to operate for two full shifts. And they've actually since rejected that. So they've said, we cannot take your material, we're focusing only on Clark County, and we're slowing down our machine so that we can make sure that we're getting out what we need to get out. They're spending more time pulling out all that contamination and sorting better to make sure that they can sell their product. So far, we have not had any loads rejected, and we have brokers continuing to buy our materials. One unexpected consequence of this is that other markets, the plan was sort of, well, if China doesn't want it, there's other places. There's Korea, Indonesia, there's a lot of places that will accept our material. But these other countries have taken the opportunity to also make their policies a little bit more strict. And Korea has also since said that they're going to be not accepting loads, not as strict as China, but a little bit stricter than what they were, and hasn't really opened up any more doors for us. So. Another unintended consequence is because our material is getting cleaner, some of the domestic paper mills are actually interested in the paper products that are coming out. Not enough to offset what we're not able to send overseas, but little bits here and there, and then hopefully more and more paper mills will be interested in buying this material that's now cleaner because we've slowed down the line. Internally, what county staff is working on is these stories have been popping up in a lot of media outlets. It was on the Columbian's front page for a little while. It's a big topic down in Oregon because it is against the law for them to throw away any recyclable materials that have been sorted for recycling. And in a worst case scenario, if we had no place to send our material for a temporary basis, we would have to look at landfilling our recyclable material for an amount of time for the market to come back or for us to find alternatives to that market. Whereas in Oregon, that's illegal, and they've been having to grant waivers for any loads that have had to go to the landfill. So it's been a very big topic, and we've been forced to act very quickly as far as communicating out to the public because of just kind of communication from other cities that we are sort of in the media shadow of. So Portland and Metro communicating and Seattle communicating kind of put a spotlight on us to talk. So. We're also capitalizing on this information being out in the public by creating a series of social media campaigns in partnership with the City of Vancouver and Waste Connections to both shed a light on what the situation is, on what the restrictions are, why the restrictions are in place, and what types of things we can do as residents to improve upon the cleanliness. So things like, if it's not a program material and it doesn't go into your recycling bin, don't put it in there because you think it should. So a term that's commonly referred to as wish cycling, where it's, this should be recyclable, or I think it's probably recyclable, so I throw it in there anyways, usually is what leads to a lot of the contamination. Plastic film, plastic bags, types of plastic that are not recyclable end up in there and cause a lot of contamination, as well as food soiled materials and food itself. So we're taking the opportunity to create a social media campaign that Waste Connections and the City of Vancouver will try to push out to as many of their residents as possible. So,
what's the contamination? I mean, you know, when you slow down the line, have you been monitoring the contamination? Has there been an increase or a decrease in the contamination rate?
The contamination coming in has remained the same, but what they're able to get out has been increased. So when they're putting together their bales at the end of the day, they're much cleaner and the contamination rate is lower. It's still at about 1%, so not as low as we would want. And they will break bales open and put them back through the line if they have to, which again slows down those two lanes of traffic on I-5. But it has been successful at eliminating quite a bit of contamination. But
there's two ways to look at that. There's the problem on those lines, and then there's what's coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And they're working on what's going through the line right now. And then
there's a couple
after the consumer that's putting stuff into those bins.
Yeah, it's a weird situation. I don't want to, it's not akin to the housing crisis. It's just, it's a lot of different things that were going on that kind of caused one problem. One is that we kind of learned that we just sort of leaned on China to buy a lot of material regardless of how clean it was or wasn't. So we became very dependent on them to buy the material. That sorting facility that you saw is based upon materials that were very heavy in our program even as close as 10 years ago. Packaging is getting thinner, packaging is getting lighter, so even the things that we were able to capture 5 to 10 years ago don't exist anymore, and this technology is not quite able to pull out all of the things that are there. And then it's also just what's coming in, whether the material is clean or not. So it's a series of problems that have all kind of led to one issue. So. The questions on that?
I just out of curiosity, are the ships actually monitored? So like if you ship, you take a ship over to China, they tell you they're not going to take the product. My concern would be they're going to just turn around and go out in the ocean and dump it.
I'd have to double check on that. I know that they're tracked, and we know where the ships are and what they're doing with the material. I don't know the process because that's so far out of our purview at this point, because it's transferred. That's a very good question. I'd actually need to follow up on that, and I can probably bring some information back or send back. So I'm not going to say it's not being dumped into the ocean, but I do know that it's monitored. They've paid for it. There's tariffs. There's things that have happened that I can't imagine it just disappears. But again, I've been surprised by scarier things. So
I don't know if you all have had a chance to go on Waste Connections site has a recycling ABCD, and you can actually search by, I have this weird plastic container, and you can actually search and find it in there, and it tells you whether or not it's recyclable, which has been really helpful for my husband and me, especially that's kind of our date match very sadly, but we like to find out, is this recyclable or not? But anyway, it's a very good website, so if you all have
a chance to look at
it. I know, it's very sad. I'm very, very long time.
Is it like a drinking game?
But if you all haven't had a chance to go in there, it's really cool. They've done a really good job of trying to help with the input in, because if we can also help with that, that's also going to help the back end so much more. So, yeah, so if you haven't, I'd encourage you to go take a look.
And I would add, they also have this good chart that we have hanging on our wall in the garage right by our equipment. It's got an algorithm. Is it this? Yes. Is it that? No. And you just follow along. It covers most of it.
I also will call them if I have any questions, and they're very gracious to the board answering those questions. They answer them right away. If there's something that doesn't show up on that big chart, and I'm not sure about, then I call them, and they have an answer right away. Mm-hmm. I have a question with regards to paraffin. The the products that the white stuff that can do put into the to package.
The foam.
Oh, styrofoam.
Yeah, the styrofoam. Where does that go? I mean,
are you asking where you can take it, or where does it disappear to?
Dispose of it.
How do you dispose of it? So at the central transfer station, there are styrofoam drop-offs that you can bring styrofoam. Right. If it's like packaging peanuts, those typically can go back to a UPS store or mailboxes, etc. But there are drop-off. It's too bulky and too big and breaks up too much to go curbside. If we collected a curbside, it'd be all over the streets and blowing around in the wind. So there are drop-off locations at the transfer stations, and you can bring that there.
Sure.
I believe commercial is charged, and I believe residential is drop-off.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
How come you can't recycle clamshells? There's so many of them out there.
That would be more of a contamination issue. With plastics especially, they have to be absolutely clean. So like with plastic grocery bags, for example, right? So those are absolutely recyclable. They just have to be kept separate from the system, because if they go through this system, they're so dirty and contaminated by the time they are even sorted out that they're no longer usable products. So it's more of a cleanliness issue. Just the transportation of those, collection and transportation, doesn't make it fiscally work out to transport, collect, and recycle, especially if most of it's going to be contaminated. So,
last question.
Yeah.
You probably told Nate or us, and I missed it. What does SORT stand for?
What is SORT?
Yeah.
So, what is? Oh, it doesn't stand for anything.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Just catch it.
In 2013, that makes sense. I hadn't even thought about that. From my experience, China likes to, at least my experience, what I've interacted with, China's economic campaigns have very militaristic sounding names. I don't know if that's true or not, but all I've noticed is they have very official sounding names for their economic campaigns. The first one in 2013 was called the Green Fence, and this is an expansion of the Green Fence, which is called National SWORD. But now you have me wondering. I have not found it to be an acronym anywhere, but now I'm just curious.
Oh, I thought it stood for solid waste blank recycling.
We can make something up. We can meet up afterwards. We'll make something up afterwards, because I've got a few words
solid
I could probably throw in
ongoing
there.
Ongoing recycling disruption.
Yeah, that sounds about it.
That sounds good.
Ongoing recycling disruption. So.
May I ask a question?
You may ask questions.
It's not so much about recycling as it is about composting. Is there any thought in Clark County to being able to compost food, kitchen and food waste and pizza boxes and green bins?
In green bins, like curbside?
In the yard. So I have
there's
a yard. And I've lived in communities where you were encouraged to put food waste, pizza boxes, things like that, because it was composting. Is there any movement towards that in Clark County?
I would point you first towards our Master Composter program that encourages sort of a on-site, like, composting of food waste at home. That obviously, I live in a condo. I'm not allowed to have a worm bin in my house to compost our food waste.
And I don't want one.
That's the other, right? Let's be honest. Not everybody wants one. I would say that there's, you know, it's always we're always wanting to do more to get more waste out of just divert it to the right location. It's just a matter of capacity for a program that would be city or county wide being able to do. We have a location that can handle that much food waste. And can we do it in such a way where it is not contaminated? You know, we can look at some programs in the area's models. You know, I live in Portland right now, and they had a very robust program and had to walk back some elements. So a lot of it's just making sure that we have the capacity to handle it, and that we can do it in a way that makes cost sense to the residents. So it's definitely, it's always on the table. It's just a matter of making it a priority or making sure we can do it in a way that makes sense for the entire county. So, but it's not something we're avoiding. It's just definitely on the table with
no
other programs. I've only been here 3 months, so unless there's secret plans I can't tell you about, but I don't know. So.
You did it very successfully in Spokane. Mm-hmm. Big trend, and we could use the same green bins that you poured your grass clippings into and food waste, and it was very convenient. And I think it also took some of the contamination out of the recycling stream too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that food waste is definitely a big piece. So we can look at Spokane for sure. So
I had a quick question before we move on to that answered?
Sure.
Is that answered?
Absolutely. Go for it.
But, you know, I mean, I think that part of our recycling campaign is to keep things, you know, from going into the landfills, which is an environmentally conscious way to go. But it seems kind of silly that we're shipping and we're using all of the contaminants to actually bale and package and then have a huge ship traveling all the way to China. You know, I mean, so people ask if that, I mean, so say this doesn't, say that doesn't work and China says, no, we don't want your trash, you trash. And we need to actually, what is the plan? Or do we have a plan on what's, what we're going to do? I mean, I think it would be, seems like you should have a better plan than shipping it off.
So I will say, I mean, it's a much longer story, but the convenience of shipping it to China was born out of empty containers moving back over there. So they were shipping products here, empty containers, empty ships heading back over there. So from an environmental standpoint, and if you track the amount of environmental benefit, materials can travel a very long way to be recycled before they become environmentally detrimental to continue to transport it that way. I don't know if that, I mean, it's a big algorithm.
You feel better about it.
Yeah. You know, that being said, we have to be prepared to amend our program to, I mean, we want to be A, honest with our residents that we're not accepting materials if they're not being recycled. And that's not always a popular decision for sure, but we're not going to collect something and then be throwing it away, but telling people that it's being recycled. We also are, you know, we need to be prepared to kind of amend what's going into the bins if we have to. It's a lengthy and complicated process, but if we have to remove things from our curbside system to ensure that what is valuable and what does have large environmental impacts are getting recycled, then we have to be prepared to, you know, we don't have to be, but we are prepared to kind of make those suggestions or to think about removing or amending our program. But the other bigger piece is that, you know, we identified the root causes of this, and it's recycling performance at the curb, and it's technology, and then it's you know, restrictions on where we're shipping things. So we don't have a lot of options on where we can ship things. It's just not feasible in the United States that it doesn't, the economy to support that doesn't exist here as far as processing. And I don't know how to bring that to Clark County for sure, but shipping it elsewhere isn't really a viable option. Also, you know, if you look at shipping it to Korea, all we're doing is continuing the same behavior. We're just making it somebody else's problem. So, but also doing a lot of this education, focusing on how to either A, prevent waste or any material that's being diverted from your home into garbage or recycling in the first place, but also communicating that if you have that waste, it needs to go in the right
place. And Waste Connections is public. It's not a city. It's
a private company.
Private company. I mean, I don't know their business model of like how much money they're actually making. Like, I mean, it seems like, are they, is it a growing business? Or are they really scrounging by? Is it, you know, is it like, so how much money are they?
I wouldn't call them scrounging, but recycling in any jurisdiction
is not a
profitable
business.
No, and that's, I think, a big piece of the picture that so often gets left out is that recycling costs a lot of money, and it is very energy intensive.
Right.
And to do it takes a lot of logistics that get spread out elsewhere. So,
it must also be dependent on global commodities prices. I mean, if the global cost of, you know, cost of plastic is low, or metals or paper is low, then they're going to be more picky about it.
Yeah.
If the commodity prices are high, then they're going to be more open market.
When our fuel prices are cheap at the pump, we have no market for plastics, or we have very little return on market for plastics because virgin materials are cheaper. So it totally blew me away when I got into this industry how dependent upon uncontrollable variables recycling is. We try to have a consistent program, but we're very, very conservative with adding new materials because unless we know that that's going to be there for the next 10 to 20 years, it's not worth adding. And I would say that in my lifetime, I didn't expect this problem to be happening with paper.
Mm-hmm, yeah,
plastic, yeah, that's right. Getting worse and worse. But with paper, I didn't expect this. And yeah, this kind of caught everybody off guard. So
Elon Musk needs to start a new company for like the Tesla version of recyclable.
I keep tweeting at him, but he won't respond.
Virtual.
Awesome building materials, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, see all these, you know, interesting ideas.
And do we know?
Oh, China built, or Japan built an airport on compacted garbage, by the way. Yeah. We'll talk more about that later. But
what about medical waste? Does that go through the same terminal? Because that's where we
Medical waste has its own separate process and has to go to its either own designated landfill or an incinerator process, but it's handled separately from the rest of this. Hopefully. That's not to say that medical waste doesn't end up in that facility. Medical waste ends up everywhere, but it's not a really big problem for us. Medical waste is definitely diverted elsewhere. So
I know there's been a lot of concerns about, you know, healthcare without harm, and the, you know, we've gone to the proliferation of all this disposable stuff. And I mean, I've been a nurse for 45 years, and you know, some of the old-fashioned things, we would be better, our environment would be better than throwing all this stuff away.
Yeah, there's a lot of trade-offs to be made for convenience and ease. So I just want to touch really quickly on inclement weather, just so you, I think Janice, you just wanted to kind of, just an overview in storm weather.
Yes, at one of the past back meetings, it came up right around the time of the fires, and residential garbage pickup was potentially affected. And then last winter, we had a couple days where garbage service was interrupted. So I just, we had talked about it in this group, so I thought maybe it would be helpful for Travis to give us an update on how our program, along with Waste Connections, plans for responding.
Yeah, and I don't have any other pictures because you all know what snow and you all know what garbage looks like, so I don't have any other pictures after this. I just wanted to give you kind of a quick rundown of the process. So for residential and commercial solid waste and recycling, it's really at the decision-making of Waste Connections, because they carry the liability for their drivers, and if they deem it unsafe for their drivers to be out in the road, either for the drivers or the general public, low-hanging wires, traffic, those kinds of things can become a big problem when it's icy or snowy out. And I'm going to paint a picture of our most likely snow and ice, and I'll touch very quickly on the hopefully the anomaly that was the fire in the gorge. But really, commercial routes start at 4 o'clock in the morning, so they have supervisors that are out driving the routes that they would be making that day at 2 o'clock in the morning, and then they make a judgment call at around 2 to 4 o'clock in the morning as to whether or not they're going to cancel or delay the routes for that day. Obviously, they know some of the more hilly parts of the county are always going to be a problem, so they drive some of the more easily accessible parts to check and see whether it's safe or not. And they will, if they deem it too dangerous, they will cancel the routes for that day. And they have a phone tree, or they have a calling process that goes out to their customers in that route that notifies them that their garbage will not be picked up that day, and that either A, it will be picked up the following business day, or B, it will be picked up and they will be allowed to put out double the waste the following day. So if it's a Tuesday and it's canceled, it will either be picked up on the following day, Wednesday, or double the volume the following Tuesday. So that usually works out well, but last year, I don't know if anybody was impacted, but I think we had about 3 Thursdays in a row that were canceled. It just sort of happened to fall on that Thursday. So that ended up being that they brought on some extra drivers to go out on those following business days, because at some point, storing garbage on site becomes a health problem. So if they do cancel routes, they do reserve some of the more senior and experienced drivers and some of their chained or snow tire trucks for critical accounts. So hospitals, multifamily properties where the garbage builds up very quickly. Any place where there's going to be either a public health risk with the garbage that's being stored on site, or just a huge collection of garbage that either 24 hours or a week of delay would cause significant problems. And typically for ice and snow, having an extra bag of garbage outside, vectors are low. Smells are not necessarily a big problem, so having an extra bag or two or an extra can of garbage outside isn't as big of a deal. And I say it's not as big of a deal. It's still inconvenient, but these judgment calls are for public safety and for the safety of the drivers. Additionally, they notify us at about 3 o'clock in the morning. I don't know who, I hope it's not me, but I don't know who they notify at 3 o'clock in the morning.
You've been here for 3 months, we haven't told you yet.
I have no idea. It hasn't snowed yet, so.
You haven't told me.
That also creates a phone tree for us, the Clark County staff, City of Vancouver staff, and then we are also able to notify the appropriate people, mostly I'm supposed to call you at 3:30 in the morning. And then we just notify the proper people and then make sure that all of our lines are open and that our voicemails are up to date and that our website shares any relevant information about what the changes in service are. The fire this summer painted a different picture where it was hot, it was warm, most of the world existed indoors and people were still working and functioning, but these drivers were outside. It came down to the line as to whether or not they were going to provide service or not, which obviously when it's hot and it's the middle of summer, it paints a different, it's a different scenario than icy and snowy outside. So ultimately, thank goodness, they ended up going out and driving. The drivers felt fine. The air quality that day was, it improved drastically. And we were able to, Waste Connections was able to go out and collect. The big problem with the gorge was storage. They actually shut down all of our garbage, all of our garbage is taken down to Tidewater and it is loaded onto barges and the barges are shipped up the river to Boardman, Oregon and then loaded onto trucks and taken to the landfill. They actually shut down the river, which again, something I never thought I would experience. It's usually a fail-proof plan to ship your garbage up a river that doesn't really freeze over, so we have not had any problems. And that created a backlog. For every boat that went up and back, we had to get a waiver from the Coast Guard. So because it presented a public health risk, they were able to get our barges up and back. But it did delay, and we ran into some issues with where we can store the garbage that can't be shipped. So we are working with Tidewater and Waste Connections to make sure that we have a few days of containers that if we get a backlog like this again and fires become more common and shutting down the gorge becomes another common thing, then we are prepared to store our garbage and ship it. And then we're also working on a plan to kind of look at other landfills that we can truck our garbage to in the region.
If I remember correctly, the other problem is we didn't have a truck substitute either because 84 and 14 were closed down.
So if they close 84, they close Highway 14 to truck traffic. So
and the river was closed.
The river was closed. So our only options were to store the garbage or to drive our garbage up to another landfill and pay a huge premium on somebody else's landfill. I even called up my old boss and he would let me dump some stuff for free. But
your boss would talk to you?
I'm his favorite. So I'm sure there's more information. It seems like the winters, even the summers now are changing. Again, fire situation was new. It pointed out a whole bunch of weaknesses that nobody had ever considered a problem because the gorge doesn't shut down. So, but now that's a new thing, and we need to be prepared for other situations and have a plan. And I'm sure at some point in the future we can present. I know CRESA is working on our disaster debris management plan. So what happens with the solid waste in the area, both the solid waste that we're generating plus just any debris that comes from a storm or a disaster event, where all of that goes. So I believe CRESA is working with a vendor or is in the process of hiring a vendor to develop our debris disaster management plan so that we are ready for any any garbage situation that comes our way. So, I think I took up all of the time I possibly could. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, Travis, I'm interested in your background. How did you get into this? I'm serious. If somebody's interested, can you get go to school and learn about waste management?
I don't know. I think you can. I have a degree in poetry, so we can talk afterwards and I can paint the picture of how I got here. So, you can, and that would have been smart, but I did not do that. So I don't think anybody thinks about solid waste necessarily as a career choice. I think a lot of the people just fall into it.
It's an invisible issue.
It is, and
it's pay attention to, you know.
And the last thing, as I will say, is once you start to learn the system, all you see are garbage trucks everywhere. Like, you would be amazed the number of semis you drive by that are full of our garbage. When I lived in Tacoma, about 60% of the train traffic was garbage being moved on rails. Like, all you see is garbage everywhere.
In the last 3 months, we've had a lot more garbage in Clark County. I don't know whether you've noticed that since we hired him.
There's a whole series in the Washington Post. I don't know if it's this month or last week, but it's a whole series about the global garbage crisis.
Yeah.
And it's about our recyclable waste that's piling up in China, or electronic waste that's piling up, or chemical waste that's being shipped to Africa because somebody will look the other way and they can dump this stuff in the ground. And it is a global issue.
Last thing I will say is I grew up in Battleground, so that's the other way to start.
I knew I liked you.
Yeah. Kindergarten through high school, I was there the whole time. So yeah.
I'll have to check your records.
We should have talked to you 4 months ago.
I would like to add that we are one of the few public health jurisdictions that has solid waste. I think how many other jurisdictions? Just one other or two other
in the state?
I believe there's one here. I know Washington County and Oregon does, and I believe there's one or two very small counties that are in their health department, but everything is all together. So.
But I think just even with Travis's presentation tonight, we can really see there's a huge intersection between what happens in solid waste and how it impacts public health. So I think this has been a great opportunity for us to learn more about the solid waste world, but also incorporate some of the public health messages with the work that they do.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's also interesting when you think back to the work that we did on the Growing Healthier Report.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the chapter on climate change. It makes me now think, did we think about solid waste in that plan in terms of, fires and the gorge, the whole thing about how we build, in the Growing Healthier Report. It's just like, it makes me wonder, with just what's happened and what we've learned, because we know climate change is going to have a big impact on this.
Yeah, and Travis and I were just at, what was the conference, Wasalfa Wasac, the Washington...
Wswampum Wasac Wasalfa.
Yeah, but we, Councillor Bolt was there, Chair Bolt was there, and so I just asked him, I said, so how do the councillors feel about climate change these days? And so, he said that they're comfortable talking about certain aspects of climate change if we don't use those words. And so one of the things Travis is going to be working on is how do we talk about climate change to the counselors in a way that's palatable for them so we can start to have those conversations, because it is going to continue to have a huge impact. Yeah, I thought about the Growing Healthier Report too.
One of the things about being on this for as long as we have is that, and Mark's contributions and stuff, but water and sewer rule the world. Like, I was just telling my sister on the way here, you wouldn't believe how important water and sewer are to almost everything that goes on. And the public doesn't understand what that, but I would never have either. I mean, of all the reports we've ever had, about what happens with septic or with, just water and sewer, if you don't have that, be worried. Because it's going to go bad very quickly.
Yeah.
And this is just another example. Last year we have recycling, but the holidays landed on Thursdays as well. So if you're in a house and your pickup's Thursday and Christmas is on Thursday, and that means New Year's Day is on Thursday, and then you have 3 days of snow on Thursday, it is an uncomfortable situation. And there's only one place to call, right? Unless you're hauling it yourself, there's nothing you can do. So seriously, I mean, I don't know what we can do about it, but it's really been obvious.
That was one of the things super important. Puerto Rico, too, that you hear about in the news, is the amount of trash that they were
right.
I mean, that's exactly right. It's and it was a public health problem.
Well, the changes didn't really start until about the 1970s, before it was just landfills and they were on fire. Everything. The health department that I worked at, I had to make sure the landfill wasn't burning all the time. The people would go burn it. I can remember posting a big sign up there. I was ordered by the county commissioners. On the front page of the local paper was my sign burning up.
Well, they just start on fire themselves sometimes. They just combust.
And then we had community members light it on fire, too.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. But I can remember in the 70s, Department of Ecology coming down with solid waste ordinances and the involvement the counties had and the expense. The landfill here, Leipner's, was the leachate contamination of the groundwater. The millions that were spent there, it's all that, burning methane off and coming up with a plan to barge it. A lot's been done.
Yeah.
In my current role with Vancouver's Downtown Association, I was a volunteer to be on a committee that talked about dumpsters in downtown. If you look on 9th Street in downtown Vancouver, just off Main, there are dumpsters.
there's a very 55-gallon barrel drum that's for grease residue that's sitting. And you walk by that on a summer day, and you know it very quickly. And the fact of the matter is that downtown Vancouver has suddenly become very, very prosperous and very, very busy. And all those restaurants and all those brew pubs generate garbage. And there's no place to put it. The Mighty Bowl that just opened in downtown Vancouver, I think they're on, must be on 8th. Any restaurant in downtown Vancouver now must have space for a dump, interior storage space for a dumpster. You cannot, a new restaurant cannot put dumpsters on the sidewalk. And so we've been part of a task force to figure out how do we manage garbage downtown? Where do we put it? How do we get the dumpsters for people who might be blind or disabled and walk into them? So it's a significant issue in downtown Vancouver right now. How do we manage it, and how do we get it out of the way?
And so because I know the city of Vancouver has enclosure standards and they review plans. It's just retrofitting the old ones. Is that what you're, okay.
Thank you very much. Okay, so we're gonna move on to the strategic plan. And
Dr. Melnick and I are going to be tag teaming it. There's a copy of the strategic plan in your packet, and we'll be talking to you about that.
So, in your packet is our new strategic plan. So, we actually need the strategic plan. As you know, we're applying for national public health accreditation. And this is the year that we're applying for it. So we've been working on our strategic plan with our managers. And we have this, the strategic plan basically aligns with our mission, vision, and values. We've created this mission, this strategic plan to also align with some of the modern public health system in terms of what the modern role of public health is. And I won't go into real detail about that, but I think we may have spoken to you in the past about the community health strategist model and public health 3.0. So we've developed these first two pages for you. Our managers are actually working hard on developing work plans and metrics that go along with the strategic plan. So we'll be working on that over the next several months. What we're asking from you is we need the strategic plan approved by the Board of Health, and we're bringing the strategic plan to the Board of Health next week, December 13th. And in your packet, I think we drafted a letter from, if you guys approve, from the Public Health Advisory Council recommending to the board, to our Board of Health, to, as in your role as advising the Board of Health, to recommend that they approve the strategic plan. So I don't know, Roxanne, Janice, Jeff, do you want to add anything to what I've said about the strategic plan?
It's been a very, very good process. It's been a while since we updated our strategic plan, and we really wanted it to be a collaborative process with our management team. And so it's been a very, very good process. And what they've been able to do too is really bring that community perspective into our dialogue as we were putting the strategic plan together. So we talk a lot about collaboration in our strategic plan now, because that's going to be critical, is that ongoing collaboration with our community partners to do the work of public health. The other thing that is really critical is really infusing this with and talking about equity and the social determinants of health that we see. And so we wanted our strategic plan to reflect that as well. And what the managers are doing, they helped us rework the vision. It hasn't changed a whole lot, but we reworked the vision, the mission, and the values. And then we also developed new priorities and goals. And their work plans will actually align with these goals. And the metrics we will be using to put together a dashboard to measure how we are doing associated with our strategic plan. So that's another piece of this that we're working on too, is that dashboard. We will be revisiting the strategic plan every single year. Even though it's a long-term strategic plan, it's a living document. We're going to be reviewing it, and we're going to be reviewing our work plans and saying, are we still in alignment? Do we need to change anything? So it's going to be an ongoing living document. However, our expectation is these first two pages are not going to change. What's going to change are the work plans. They're not going to change so much. They may change a little bit. But the what's going to change is are those work plans and potentially the metrics. So that's the piece of it that we're going to continually look at to see, are we doing everything that we can to innovatively and creatively meet the goals that we have?
Can I have a couple questions? As you worked through this, did you look at the National Prevention Strategy and the Healthy People? I know they're working on Healthy People 2030 right now. Is there alignment with what's in our strategic plan here in Clark County with those national things that are being driven down?
The national, what's going on at the national level is always part of what we're looking at, and certainly at the program level. And I do think that what we're going to see is a lot of the work plans are infused with that. A lot of what we did too with this high-level strategic plan is really aligned, like Alan said, with that community health strategist role of public health and our partners, and also sort of the modernization of public health, so public health and making sure that we have those foundational public health services sort of reflected in this plan. And then certainly in the work plan, absolutely those things, those high priority areas will be.
So there's a couple of papers that we could get them for you. It's called one is called Public Health 3.0, the new model for public health. Another one is called the Public Health as a Chief Health Strategist. We like the word community health strategist better. But basically, and I think Roxanne has already mentioned this, some of the key characteristics about the modernization of public health is the fact that we do this work in collaboration. We don't do this alone. And you'll see in here, if you look at this, you know, like the last one, demonstrate excellence in public health practice and management. One of the things about Public Health 3.0 and the community health strategist is working with new and innovative and big data sets and providing data and information for the community. So a lot of the stuff that's in here is really related to what's called public health modernization and the new models. And we'd be happy to get you some more information about that. And that also relates to the work we're doing with our statewide partners around the foundational public health services. And those include not only programs and services, but capabilities as well. So this kind of aligns with those things.
Well, I think the second thing I wanted to say is I think you're mentioning collaboration, and I think about, you know, earlier this year I shared with you from SELF the State of the Field Children and Families Report, which is drawing on the WAC Kids data about every kid in the state. And so when you talk about collaboration, public health doesn't need to do it all, but they need to collaborate with those partners and make sure it gets rolled into this plan. I mean, that the State of the Children report, when we look at the readiness of kids in our community for kindergarten, it's coming from WAC Kids data, which is mandated at the state level, and that goes under, you know, every child having a healthy start.
Absolutely.
You know, collaborating with those organizations that are
The other thing you'll notice in here, besides the collaboration piece and the data piece, is the fact that we work a lot at the policy level. So that's also a less direct services, because our partners can do a lot of that, and more working at the policy level.
And Jim, back to what you were saying, our epidemiologists are working with SELF right now on the State of the Children report, and they've actually pulled in some really, we're pulling in some economists and other things, people that have not necessarily been at the table before, to help us with that data analysis piece. And it's really, really interesting. So it's very engaging, and we're really excited about helping with that report. So
I have a question. So does Board of Health understand that there's a need to move in the direction of this modernization conceptual framework, or is this going to be all brand new information for them?
We meet with them monthly, and you guys are all always invited to come to a Board of Health meeting. But we've been presenting this material to them all along, so I don't think this will be brand new for them.
We've also presented to them about accreditation and the reason for why we're doing accreditation, so that won't be hopefully a big surprise.
So I guess I have a question about the movement. I mean, you've always worked a lot in policy, around policy development, you talked about a lot of data-driven and how they bring reports together. Is that to support the partners who are doing the on-the-ground work, that's doing the so here's the information, here's the policy, so what does that mean to the consumer or to the child? And that a program has to help happen for that. So is that the support work that you do for the partners that are doing the on-the-ground work?
Yeah,
so we're doing less program development and more
exactly
and policy.
So, like for example, our assessment unit works really closely with some of our partners, and we work really closely with the Southwest Washington Accountable Community of Health, and we've been really involved in the what's called the data and learning team, and our epidemiologists are very involved with that. So we bring that information there. We're really involved in work around policy work around opioids with partnering with the Accountable Community of Health. So yeah, the answer to that question is that's one of the strengths and that's one of the resources we bring to that process. And that's what we call
really
it strategy.
Just that you got to make sure that the groundwork is being done too. And so the work you're doing is to support the agencies or the groups that are doing that groundwork. And that's a great partnership and that's really needed. But I just wanted to make sure that that didn't, I see that as being a little bit of a shift away from some of the program work, but
right.
The data and the policy work is really important. It takes a lot of time.
So the Prevent Coalition is working on marijuana prevention, and our epidemiologists are really working closely on that. Actually, we're going to be talking a work session of our board next week around marijuana and marijuana prevention. So, but yeah, supporting our partners around chronic disease prevention is something that we bring to the table. Or that's the way we want to work, is our, yeah, you can't do this alone.
No. So what we're asking you to do is we have a draft letter printed, and there's inadvertently there's some highlights on this sheet, so we'll be updating this letter, but the text is there. And what we'd like to do is we'd like to see if you would be okay with the motion and then moving forward with that to have Stephanie sign a letter of support for the Board of Health to approve our strategic plan. The letter is actually in your packet, so you can review it. And if you're amenable, then you can go through the process of asking for a motion in a second.
I move we approve this I think we have to, we have always, on the council, Sandy, mm-hmm. Alan, we know from the very beginning we've been very strong supporters of the strategic plan of public health, and I think it just gives us tools as the council as well. So mm-hmm. I strongly support this and move that we send this letter.
Second.
Who's second?
Two? All three.
Perfect.
Wow.
Wonderful.
We almost had enough space for a third.
So
Stephanie,
you have
the
letter in your packet.
Mm-hmm.
And if
I think this is very exciting.
Yeah, this is a very exciting.
We're really thrilled about moving forward with the accreditation process. We're gathering all stuff together and so we'll keep you apprised as to how that's moving along this year.
Yeah, and the process has been really fun with the managers. It's been, well, I don't know if they feel that way, Travis.
Yeah.
It's been great. It's been lovely.
They're working really hard right now because not only are we working on this, but we're doing the foundational public health services assessment. And yeah, there's a lot of stuff that's going on.
And I just wanted to make a quick announcement. So some of you may be aware of this, but Clark County was named one of the healthiest companies by the Vancouver Business Journal. So we wanted to say yay, Clark County. And several of our folks actually work with the County Wellness Committee as well as our Building Wellness Committee, and some folks that are on our chronic disease prevention team, Melissa Martin and Cindy Meyer. And they've been really they've done a terrific job with trying to infuse some healthy behaviors, healthy structures into different businesses around the community. And we have been one of their favorite pilot projects here at the county. So some of the things they've done is they've updated the county nutrition policy to reflect current healthy standards, which is great. They work with the vending machines vendor to actually have more healthy choices in our vending machines across the county. They promoted the New American Plate 12-week challenge from the American Institute of Cancer Research, and that's about sort of healthy eating. We're in the process of holding the Great Holiday Weigh-In event, promoting maintain, don't gain over the holidays. So we did one over Thanksgiving, and we're going to do another one. I don't know how successful we were, so we'll see. We're still waiting for the findings on that, but we're going to do the same thing over the Christmas holiday, too. We've also established Walking Wednesdays and Take the Stairs campaigns that encourage physical activity. In some of our stairwells, as you're walking up, they've actually put these sort of affirmations like, be grateful.
Stay strong, keep going.
You know, enjoy every bite. You know, so as you're walking up your stairs, you're giving all these like, you know, really, really great things. So they've done a really good job, and that's one of the reasons why they received this recognition. So I just wanted to show that with you, that we're going to do something like this for them. Thank you.
Okay, so just a quick update on the executive committee. So we do have a new member update. So Marla had already shared with us hers. And so I was wondering if we could just have Sandy share a little bit of information about yourself.
Sure. My name is Sandy Brown, and I recently retired in September. And I've known about this committee. I've worked for WSU Extension and partners with public health on a lot of different projects around the health in the community and prevention work. And I've always been interested, but felt like it was a conflict of interest because I had lots of things going on in my job. And so when I retired, a consumer opening came on this board, and so I threw my hat in the ring. I'm really pleased to be here, and I'm really interested in not only the aspects I've been involved with in my work over the last 38 years, but also some of the new things around wells and septics and waste and things like that that also influence our health that I've not known a lot about. So I'm really glad to be here and want to learn more.
And then, Ron, do you want to, because Sandy doesn't know any of your background, do you want to just share?
Sure, just really quick, because I think many of you have heard this before, but I just recently retired from Peace Health after 15 years there, and prior to that, 27 years with Seattle Children's Hospital in Seattle, and I've done some public health nursing in Bush, Alaska for 3 years back in the mid-70s when there wasn't a lot of the services like, you know, telephone or TV or even access often on the island that had been full plane. So I've done a lot of different things and enjoy very much being a representative of Peace Health on this advisory council. And so I was very delighted that there happened to be an opening at the time when I transitioned away from my work at Peace Health into private life and the consumer public health services. So thank you. Nice to meet you.
Welcome, and I'm glad you're both here. All right, then just an update on the nomination committee. Joan, do you want to speak to that, or?
We came up with a slate, but I can't remember.
So the slate right now is Adrian.
Adrian, and then Remy and Bob.
Bob
and Remy. And I think Bob would be the
co-chair,
and then Remy would be the member at large. And so Steve and I and she's not here.
Melanie.
Yeah, we met with just a couple weeks ago and proposed that slate, contacted people, and so that's what we're recommending to the council.
So Bob is vice chair, right?
Vice chair. Chair. Oh, sorry.
Vice chair.
So I don't have to run a meeting unless she's gone, right?
Not until next year. You're out here. Just saying.
And I understand they've all agreed. So
I thought we changed the terms of the executive committee, so now they're going to be like 5 years.
Yes. What's wonderful about serving on this nominating committee is, it's interesting because, you know, we even had people saying, "Hey, look, it's an opportunity for people to step forward, do the job for a while, and still continue on the council." And it's really a fun committee to be on because it's, you know, people are receptive, and thank you, Adrian and Bob and Remy, for stepping in and doing this on behalf of the council.
Perfect. Thank you.
All right.
So you guys have to vote, right?
Yeah.
At the next meeting.
Do we vote now, or do we vote in?
I thought we vote now and then they vote no and then they take office in January.
Got it. Okay. Reading the motion.
I move to slate of candidates as presented by
Should we have them step out of the room?
No.
So we have a motion.
Keep going.
Same motion before.
I move that we approve the slate.
No, we have the motion. You can second.
Sorry, so we have second.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. We have to, so all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed?
No.
Yes, I've done so well with these Roberts.
You're awesome. All right, so we have just a few minutes or time for council member updates.
I have something. One of the things I wanted to call out for this team is that there's been some, there's a money in the state for marijuana and tobacco that goes out, and there's a lot of politics behind that. You can imagine the amount of money and so on. So there is a movement in the state to have that money shift away. And as I understand it, Clark County was the only place in the state that continued to allow ESD 112, that's doing an amazing job with that funding, to keep it. That they were a collaborative process that continued in the face of really not collaborative process in every other health district or place in the state of Washington. So I don't serve at 112 anymore, but I'm close with the people that do, and that's remarkable that there's good work going on and that it didn't come down to grabbing funds, but continued. And I know, Alan, that you were a big part of voicing that and continuing with it. So I don't know if I'm being really articulate right now, but it's a cool thing that happened. And I just want to say publicly that it was nice work.
Well, that's kind of you. I think there was the way the marijuana and tobacco money got out there. Yeah, we took a look at it in terms of the RFP that was done by the state, and it made most sense for us. And it wasn't just me, it was our entire team, and you guys can speak up for the set, the way the system that was already in place and the collaboration was already going made the most sense. I can't speak to what other health jurisdictions did or did not do, but I think it's a reflection on us, but it's also a reflection on the community and the great work and the great partnerships we have here. I know there's some issues between the statewide prevention alliance and the public health system, but our partnerships down here are really strong and really good.
It's one thing to speak about collaboration, it's another when funding and decisions come up and to say, no, our partners are doing a really good job, let's continue with that good work so we don't go backwards five steps just because there's funding that could shift, if everybody understands what I'm saying. So it's a real shout out to collaborative process. I think it's the way it should be done, and I'm kind of proud to be from here, so good job.
Thank you. I just wanted to give an update. The ACES Action Alliance is alive and well, and Cindy Myers is going to be in a more formal leadership role with our alliance right now. We're doing a lot of work on our community outreach team and planning events for this next year, so anybody who's interested from the council in joining us, you're welcome. Right now, the Alliance, we have over 200 individual members who come to the meetings. Not everybody comes at the same time, but 40 organizations that are working with us to increase the awareness and really promote resilience in the community. So it's been challenging to try to come up with ways to measure our success. But we continue to work on that. And our program last month was really particularly interesting. It was on the Council for the Homeless and other agencies in Clark County, Community Services Northwest share, that received a grant and really implemented trauma-informed care approaches, which is really important. If you're dealing with a population who's been traumatized, what you don't want to do when they come in for services is to have that experience re-traumatize them. So Kate Budd, who is The deputy director of the Council for the Homeless, soon to be the director come February, gave a presentation on implementation of the trauma-informed approaches at the Council for the Homeless and the agency. It was an excellent program, well-attended. And so we have great programs every month because our monthly meetings tend to be educational in nature, and then the work that's going on in smaller action teams. We have a schools team, the outreach team, the assessment and evaluation team, and we're working on establishing a health team, working with trying to increase the awareness of ACEs in our population of healthcare providers. It's just, we're rolling along. I want to say that the work of ACEs came about because of this, what we did on this council. When we first, several years ago, said it's a priority issue. And again, we don't always do all the work. And so by saying we needed to work on this, there were lots of people in the committee who got together and said, okay, now we need to do this. But it came about because of what happened here at the council.
Didn't the council support the raising of America? I mean, there's some things that you guys did.
Oh, yeah, raising of America.
Raising of America.
Yeah. And it's a whole community. I mean, it's, and you again, guys like Sandy talks about collaboration in the world of what's going on with ACEs. Let me tell you, that's what the Alliance is trying to do, is to align. Nobody's trying to take away what somebody else is doing, but building on it. And that's been the beauty of this Alliance, is just the incredible collaboration that's going on across all of our agencies.
And you guys have been really helpful in getting all this in front of the Board of Health as well.
The Free Clinic has started ShareHouse project. I don't know if you're familiar with that. If you're ever on the Free Clinic board, you would be, because it's years in the making. Last Wednesday, we finally saw our first medical and dental patients together with two separate vans. It's a start. We saw, I think, maybe 8 or 10 patients on each side of the house. The main reason I'm telling you this, work on your own providers to get them to participate, because, you know, physicians and dentists are the biggest, hardest part for us to get to volunteer to see these patients. I mean, there's other, all sorts of other support, but the professionals are tough to get on our side. And I know they're busy, but, you know, it's so gratifying to do these projects. I do a lot of these projects by volunteering, and it's really rewarding, especially at times like this during the holiday season, to see these families that have absolutely nothing, just to get them out of pain, just to give them some comfort, just to talk to them, you know, sympathize with them, empathize. But you know, work on your own health providers to see if they maybe want to volunteer some of their time, just to an hour or two a month, it's all we're asking.
So, Remy, I heard that you guys had the van, the unit down by ShareHouse, and that
literally
some of the of the clients were concerned about leaving their stuff. And yeah, so you guys are developing some innovative ways of actually going to where the folks are. So I don't know if you want to talk about that a little
bit. Yeah, it's kind of a learning process as we go through this, but dental was there at the end of October, and the first thing we noticed is, yeah, everybody shows up for meals at ShareHouse, but they also bring all their stuff with them, and they don't want to stray far from their stuff because other people will steal it. So it's a different, totally different thought process for a community. So we're trying to work out a way where it can be more lit, and we can have somebody actually watching over their stuff while they're getting treatment on the vans. Yeah, crime, security, it's a whole bunch of issues that are looked at differently with homeless, and it's an interesting project.
So whatever you learn from this, and not only provide better service, but this could be translated elsewhere in terms of
exactly
how to provide service to a homeless population.
Exactly.
I think it's really cool.
Yeah, it's interesting. Piques my interest.
Is there talk then of having that collaboration with the new DASEN? Would that be an idea?
The new DASEN?
Of having like
medical and dental services provided at the day center that's being proposed at the Fish and Wildlife Building?
We'd like to expand. Cost is one of the big things, so if you know any generous donors out there, free clinic, we'd love to hear about them. We'd love to do this every, at least twice a month, if not every week. Personally, I'd like to see it two or three times a week, because I think there's such a need out there. If you've ever been out to west of downtown to see the homeless community out there, it's a lot. I work at the jail too on Monday mornings, and at the crack of dawn, you'll see people just scattering out into the community, just kind of disappearing during the daylight hours. But boy, at night, they come right out of the woods to get whatever services they can. So it's a different world.
Do you get where do you get all of your medications and things? Are they all donated? What are your
any place you can.
All donated from?
They can't be expired. A lot of pharmacy companies, free clinic actually through donations, will try to purchase the basics. You know, basic antibiotics, diabetic medications. Diabetes is big out there. Antibiotics for infections. Any place we can get it. Donations are great.
Is there any pharmacy restrictions on donated medications that you take in to give away? It came up in a doctor's meeting at the clinic with donated medications. We have a donated medication area for people who come in that cannot afford treatment, and so we have a big cabinet of, we do have expired medications in there. That was a big discussion on, you know, is this illegal to have? And I guess and then we have Portland Animal Welfare I work quite a bit with, and so it was a homeless pet free shelter, and so that was all donated medications as well. But just the legality, it's different obviously than human medicine, but
we do have pharmacists on our board that screens that and heads that department. I know it can't be expired. He gets a lot of deceased patients. The family members will donate a lot of medications, so they'll verify that.
So will you look at the medication? So the bottle will have somebody else's name, but you can actually give that to somebody else?
Yeah, I don't know what he does. I mean, we're so hard up.
Well, the owner of the clinic was concerned about this, and I'm like, you know what, these people that are coming in don't have anything, and I want to give them something, and I know that I would take this for my own dog. It's just been in somebody else's house, and it's fine, but he was very concerned that we were doing something.
We don't do anything exotic, I can tell you that.
Right, but I could say that, you know, the human medicine side does something similar in some ways.
Call the free clinic and ask for a pharmacist on the board, and he'll be able to give you our guidelines.
I'm sure it's
because we do have guidelines.
I'm sure it's a lot more strict with human medicine.
Takeback events can't donate drug takeback to free clinics. Why the heck can't we figure that out?
Because there's no way to verify.
I know, but
it's open,
sadly.
Really.
It's an interesting idea.
It's certainly one that would be why the heck not?
Because the amount of work that would go into verifying it and making sure people...
And you know what, Alan? It would save the landfills from being polluted. I'm not even joking.
Yeah, well, there's some other... we can talk more about drug take back.
Just saying.
One
there they go.
Some other plans.
Free clinic pharmaceuticals. I don't know if this is still, I think it's still occurring, but I believe that the free clinic can tag on to Peace Health's medication buying program so that they can get at a lower rate. And so that helps with some of those especially things that are used a lot. It doesn't take care of everything, but that's my understanding.
Yeah, I think it's really Walmart's. They purchase the most from Walmart because they get a better deal than Peace Health. I do know Peace Health helps when they can, depending on what drugs. The pharmacist knows more about that because he runs the whole program.
Yeah.
But yes, money number one. And if you can donate verifiable drugs, that'd be great. So basic drugs, Advil, Aleve, ibuprofen, antibiotics are good. So.
You want some dog antibiotics?
Thank you.
It's not the same. We can do some augment.
Augment. Remy, if I could just add to your observations about Sharon, there's a homeless ideas group in downtown Vancouver,
And we hear from a lot of different agencies, and one of them was from an agency in Portland that has converted an old shipping container into storage for homeless people. And my first question was, why? And they said, well, first of all, because they can't go get a job, they can't go apply for Social Security, they can't go to the doctor unless they can store their stuff. A lot of them won't go unless they can store their personal belongings. So this is a locked, staffed, lighted facility that also has a hand washing station. Mm-hmm. And they can also frequently get things like clean socks and underwear. Mm-hmm. And they can also kind of get interactions with another human being who's not judgmental. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting that you would describe that our things, our belongings, really define who we are, no matter what state.
Well, Steve, that's why you see them pushing carts around.
Absolutely.
They can't leave it by themselves, right? Otherwise they'd lose whatever few possessions they have. But yeah, little things that you can do, like gym, washing their feet. I mean, that is so appreciated by the homeless. Yep. And prevents a lot of problems, just simple actions like that.
Oh, yeah.
So, but, you know, we do have quite a homeless community here.
Mm-hmm. And amazing how little things, like someplace to store your stuff and wash your hands, can make such a profound change in somebody's life.
Well, I think your comment about coming out at night, that's what I've noticed. Just not in downtown Vancouver, but in Orchard's area and stuff.
Yeah, right.
It's really bad.
It's a different society.
Yeah, well, with the rents rising rapidly around here and the housing crisis, it's going to get worse. And
and it's not just adults. My daughter's a first grade teacher at Harney, and she has a class of 21, and three of them are homeless. Mm-hmm. They're living in cars. And that I find deplorable, but it is. It's affecting a lot of parts of our society.
The last time there were the homeless count, more than a third of the people who were counted as homeless at the point in time count were children.
Yeah.
If I may interject, it was an interesting topic on the radio yesterday regarding crime in the Portland, Vancouver area. And theft of automobiles was up major over what the national average is, particularly in this area. And of course, part of it was because of the meth problem and everything. People would steal cars and try to dispose of them and everything. But another part, which we didn't think about, is the homeless. Is people need someplace to stay, so they would steal a car and take it out somewhere and then find that car later, maybe a few days later, and show that someone had actually lived in that car. You know, so it's kind of interesting that, you know, wherever you can find some place to live.
And as I would add too, I have some experience with this through a family member, my niece, who's an adult, and has lived in a van with her boyfriend for many years, chronically homeless. They finally got into an apartment, and I thought, oh, this is great. You know, their situation has a chance to change, which it does. But within a few weeks, someone broke into the apartment and took some of the few things that they have. And then about a week later, someone broke into the van and stole the tools that her boyfriend was using to be able to be employed. So I just felt like, you know, isn't it hard enough that, you know, they've had years of homelessness, and now when they actually have a place, they still can't feel completely safe. So I guess share that to say they really need our arms around that community to say, what can we do to help them get to a place where they can feel some stability and safety? It's a very hard place to be.
All right, well, with that, ending on a positive note, I hope everyone has a great holiday season, and then we will come back in January.
Thank you. Happy holidays,
everybody. I'm watching.
I'm going to go around.
I'm going to go around.
Good job. We'll give many other options.
Good.
birthday. Thank you for the kind words. It's announced as soon as I was in the
room.
Yeah, it's been a week. This community is different. It was every other parent.
Everyone.
Everyone of the 35 other 30.